Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning and welcome to The Show on KJZZ 91.5. In Phoenix, I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, how a new state law aimed at increasing the number of backyard casitas has affected demand for them.
And an operatic take on a legendary swordsman.
But first, it is time for the Friday newscap and some voices from the news this week.
It's hard to describe how I feel in this moment, but I see it in the eyes of my family and all of you. And I promise, I might be the first, but I will not be the last.
What we want is pretty simple. Like, we want government to stay open, and we want to answer what people are really telling us that they're worried about, which is the cost of healthcare going up.
Most of the emails I get are very positive. They're very thankful that I've ran this bill, and I'm giving parents another tool to help protect their own children, because at the end of the day, it is the parents' job. It's not my job to protect their kids.
We've never had a president that has spent his time thinking about how he's going to use the Department of Justice to go after political enemies. We've never seen this in our country's history.
The hockey community in this state is committed to bringing the NHL back to the desert, and I look forward to helping to make that a reality.
And joining me to talk about the results of a special election in a southern Arizona congressional district, a lawsuit challenging a new state law related to a Scottsdale-based business, and more, are Daniel Scarpinato of Winged Victory Agency. Daniel, good morning.
Good morning. Good to see you.
Good to see you as well. And Jason Barraza of Veritas. Jason, good morning to you.
Good morning to you. Thank you.
So, Jason, let me start with you with the special election in the 7th congressional district. This was held for a long time by the late Congressman Raul Grijalva. His daughter, Adelita Grijalva, won that election. Not much of a surprise, but I'm curious if there are any lessons in what we saw in the vote that we can carry forward with us.
The lesson here is that when you have someone who is that connected to the community, how do you knock that person off the pedestal that they're on? Right. This was not we knew that Adelita was going to be come out victorious in this race. That was no surprise. It has been waited for by the Democrats nationally. You know, she's going to be able to bring more strength to them and lessen the impact that Republicans can have in Congress. So it's a good win all around.
Daniel, a lot of, you know, political pundits and all look to special elections often, especially after a presidential election, to look for signs for what might be coming in the next year. Is there anything we can take from this, or is it such a heavily Democratic district and, you know, the daughter of, you know, of the person who held the seat and somebody who had been in public life herself? Is there maybe not much that we can take from this lesson wise?
There's not much we can take from it lesson wise. I think in many ways this was more of a legacy seat. What I will say is, in a prior life, as I've mentioned on here, born and raised in Tucson. And when I was a reporter for the Arizona Daily Star 20 years ago, Adelita was starting her career on the Tucson Unified School District Board. I don't know that I probably agree with her on much in terms of public policy or politics, but I think she's a lovely person, and I'm very happy for her. And what my hope is that even though she is a progressive, that she's kind of less of an AOC, less of somebody who's, you know, going on cable news and focused on Twitter, and that she actually is someone who's serious about policy and partnering with people like Juan Ciscomani, who's a Republican who represents the neighboring district. I think she actually could really be part of the solution to our politics today, and I'm hopeful for that, because I actually think she is a serious person, and I think we could use more of that in our politics and with the folks representing our state in D.C.
Hey, Jason, I'm curious, what kind of member of Congress do you anticipate that she will be? So obviously not sworn in yet, and there is some controversy over when that might happen. But I'm curious, what kind of congressmember you think Congresswoman-elect Grijalva might be?
I think she's going to be a strong member of Congress. I do expect her to be, to your point, Daniel, a little bit quieter at first, because I would expect her to be more of a learner first. Let me see how this process is going to work. she knows that she is going to be in that seat for a long time. Mm-hmm. She is going to hold this seat for a long time. She has time to make an impact. So she doesn't need to rush out. To your point, I don't think that she's going to look to become the firebrand from that seat, because she could do a lot of work and a lot of good for Arizona, for the country, for the Democratic Party from that seat.
Any significance, Daniel, to the fact that the state's delegation is whole now? I mean, it hadn't been. It had been missing someone for quite a while now.
Yeah, I mean, again, I think we need good representation. We need good people out there. She has not been a bomb thrower. You know, people do get Potomac fever. It's a real thing. So here's hoping that she can be part of the solution. And like I said, you know, she is a progressive, but there's so many issues facing the state and the country that just are not partisan. And I think it would be good if we could get back to that.
Daniel, let me stick with you. This week, Governor Hobbs appointed Jimmy McCain, the son of the late Senator John McCain, to the Arizona Board of Regents. You obviously served with Governor Ducey, so you're familiar with the process of figuring out who should be on the Board of Regents. I'm curious what you make of this appointment.
So I don't know Jimmy well. I do know members of his family. I know his mother very well and his sister. I think it's fair to say he's from a good family. He's served his country. He has an impressive educational background. I don't know him, and I don't want to get inside his head. I suspect some of his endorsements, like in the 24 election, had more to do with the politics of the moment, some of the issues back and forth between the McCain family and President Trump. I actually think he's likely a conservative in his heart. And so from my perspective, I think this is probably the most conservative pick that Republicans could hope for from Governor Hobbs for the Board of Regents. I think he's exactly the type of individual who we should want engaged in public service, and certainly a board that's focused on our institutions of higher education. He's more than qualified. So to me, he seems like somebody who would be a great addition to the Arizona Board of Regents.
Well, he pretty well famously said that he had re-registered as a Democrat, though. Like, mm-hmm. So do you still think that in his heart he's a conservative?
Again, I don't know him, but
sure.
that would be – I think that, you know, there's a lot – we've seen this. There's been a lot that's happened politically the last few years. But, you know, I think given the family he was raised in, his background, I don't think he's somebody who's going to go on to that board and be a partisan. I think he's somebody who's going to be serious. And you don't serve in the military and have, you know, the family he has and not be serious about these things. So I think, you know, I've not known for coming on the radio and praising picks by Governor Hobbs, but I think I think this is a good one.
Jason, what do you make of this selection?
I think it's a good pick. I also don't know Jimmy very well, but I would say that I think he's going to be capable of doing the job. I think it's a pick that should be considered. I think the real question here is the previous pick, Liz Archuleta, was there for a year, was never brought forward in the legislature for confirmation, and her term expired. What happens 1 year from now? Mark your calendars on what's going on. Will this have been acted on, or are we going to be in a similar situation?
Well, here's what I would say to that. First of all, what I like about this pick is Liz Archuleta was very much, you know, someone aligned with the progressive liberal politics of Flagstaff, a politician, you know, deeply engaged in DEI policies up there. And so it was much more of a political partisan pick. I think that what is great about this one is it doesn't feel that way. And, you know, a year from now, either, you know, we'll be in the midst of an election. I don't know what the Senate is going to do. But I think that what we've seen is with the check and balance from the state Senate, it has very much moderated the picks by Governor Hobbs. A lot of the people she's now choosing as agency heads are former Ducey appointees and employees who were actually dismissed in a very political way when she first came in. So I think what we've seen is exactly what voters want, which is some balance. And so by the Senate doing their work, it has resulted in, rather than, you know, a very progressive politician from Flagstaff being on the Board of Regents, potentially the son of John McCain. And I think that that seems like a win-win for Arizonans.
Well, so Jason, let me ask you about what you're bringing up in terms of Jimmy McCain needing Senate confirmation. There's obviously some bad blood between the Arizona Freedom Caucus members and the McCain family. Daniel referenced that earlier. Do you think that he has anything to worry about in terms of getting confirmed by the state Senate?
I think he does. I think that any nominee from Governor Hobbs is gonna have an issue at the state Senate. I think that they've purposely created a system that will do that.
They did appoint her. They did confirm her other appointee to the Board of Regents. So I don't think it's been unilateral. There's, like I said, I mean, there's some fabulous people who have been installed of late. Katie Patak, who now runs the Department of Child Safety, again, somebody who served in our administration. Michael Weishart, who had been at DES under our administration. So there's a number of people who I think have been confirmed. I think it's the people who were kind of the more extreme leftist type nominees who initially were rejected. And since then, we've seen, I think, people who are more interested in governing. And I think that's a good thing.
Well, so, Jason, I guess given what Daniel said earlier about Jimmy McCain being a serious pick, you know, sort of a policy person, not a partisan, does that give you any optimism that maybe his nomination will not face the kind of challenges that you seem concerned about?
No, because I think that the name is going to muddy the waters. The McCain name is something that is cherished here in Arizona. To your point, the Freedom Caucus hasn't necessarily had a good relationship with that name. I don't think that they're looking to mend ties between the McCain family and the Freedom Caucus in order to benefit Governor Hobbs.
All right. We'll have to leave it there for just a moment. That's Jason Barraza. I'm also joined by Daniel Scarpinato. I'm Mark Brody in Phoenix. The Friday Newscap continues in just a moment. Good morning. It's the Friday Newscap on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. My guests this week are Jason Barraza of Veritas and Daniel Scarpinato of Winged Victory Agency. Jason, some more developments this week in the story about Scottsdale and a proposed Axon development. That's, of course, the company that makes tasers, among other things. A citizens group has sued to try to block a law, and that law blocked a referendum on the city allowing this development to go into effect. The big issue here seems to be apartments that Axon wants to build as part of a headquarters and hotel and other developments up in North Scottsdale. I'm curious, like, what you make of the fact that the city kind of punted on whether or not they were going to sue. So now this private group has taken up the mantle and said, OK, we're going to do it.
Yeah. I mean, this is a great example of where you have a difference of the local jurisdiction isn't necessarily in line with the community that is surrounding that, right? I think the local jurisdiction is looking at development. They're looking at increasing the economy that's going around in the Scottsdale area. And they have this wonderful mixed-use development that is coming in that companies, that business wants to develop in the area. But the local community group is railing against that. So how far, how many resources is this community group going to be able to bring to the table in order to throw up as many roadblocks as they can?
Daniel, how delicate of a balance is this if you're a member, for example, of the Scottsdale City Council in terms of you have people in your city who are clearly unhappy with this development, but at the same time, there's always the risk that if you say no and block it, Axon, like they've had offers from other states to come move there. This is a homegrown company that has a pretty big presence here.
It does. This is growing pains. We have had an embarrassment of riches in this state in terms of growth, population, jobs, and there's some anxiety around that. There's some folks who don't want things to change, and I understand that. I mean, this Scottsdale is modernizing and changing. I've gone on the tour of Axon. I mean, this is a company that is engaged in trying to protect the lives of public safety officers. It's a great company that we should be proud of. I'm hopeful this could be sorted out. I think Adam Quasman on the Scottsdale Council is someone who's a real leader and could be the person to to bring both sides together and make this work. At the end of the day, as it relates to this lawsuit, I mean, as Ronald Reagan said, the states created the federal government. And I would add to that, the states also created local government. And so, you know, the state does have the ability through the legislature and the legislative process to do things like this. The cities are political subdivisions of the state. So I'm not an attorney, but I think that ultimately, you know, there's going to be lawsuits. It would be great if folks could get at the table and come to a resolution that keeps a fantastic company that's not only providing jobs, but it's actually engaged in really good work and figure out how to make it work with the community's desires.
Jason, on a practical level, even though the city is not the entity that is filing the lawsuit, it's this other group, does the fact that a lawsuit has been filed affect the chance for a negotiated settlement in any way?
I don't think so, because you can certainly have those conversations while the lawsuit is going on. I think the biggest impact from the lawsuit is other companies looking at what is going on with Exxon, right? It's not just about Exxon. It's a bigger question, because more companies are looking at Arizona. More companies want to relocate here, and they're going, not only am I going to have to deal with your normal permitting process, but now do I need to anticipate court cases to wade my way through before I can get up and running?
I completely agree with that. What companies want is certainty. Arizona has been really good at providing that. This kind of thing is the opposite. It's, you know, companies don't want to get pulled into the politics of the moment or whatnot. So I do think that if this isn't resolved soon, it really can create a ripple effect. And you've seen the same. I mean, look, Tucson kicked a company out the door. And you've seen what happened in Glendale and other places. This is not a good look. You do not want to be signaling that we don't want jobs. And look at what's happened in other states. That's why these people are coming here, by the way. So we don't want to go down that road.
All right. So speaking of entities that have left the valley, the Arizona Coyotes, yeah. We're a hockey team here. Yeah. They left a couple of years ago. There's now an effort led by Maricopa County Supervisors Chairman Tom Galvin to bring the NHL back mm-hmm. to the valley. Of course, they need to find a place to play. They need to find an ownership group to the issues that led them to leave in the first place. Daniel, I'm curious, just sort of from a political level, like, how do you see this as an sort of an issue, as a cause for someone, you know, an elected official like Tom Galvin?
I think it's great. It's so refreshing. I think what Tom is bringing to the board, focused on economic development issues like this. Look, we want to live in a cool place, and we, you know, this is a real city now, and it has changed a lot in the last 20 years. And so, yeah, we should have we should be making a play for these things. So I like that he is elevating the Board of Supervisors and his position to one where they're engaged in these discussions and trying to get cool things to our state. I think it's awesome.
Is this a good political issue, one that sort of – it seems like it's one that would sort of transcend partisanship.
I hope it would, right? To your point, I think this is about making Phoenix be that big city atmosphere. Big cities have national sports teams. This is the types of things that people think about with these cities. This is what they identify with. Phoenix is big enough. We need to have NHL hockey here in the Valley, and I wish them the best of luck in making it happen.
Is there – the potential for political challenges down the road, though, especially in terms of finding a place to play and how the arena will be built and how it will be paid for, where it will be built. Like, is there a danger of there being some kind of issues with that down the road, Jason?
Well, as we go down the road, so where, right? Look, if Exxon was putting their facility somewhere else, they might not be having all these issues. So now we're getting to all of the details where some of the issues might start coming out. Where do you want to put it? How much is it going to cost? What's your plan around that? Look, they have time to put all that together and come up with those answers so that they can package this in the best way possible for the electorate to really welcome a team.
Is this the kind of issue, Daniel, that might be better served to be sort of a regional, like a valley-wide kind of coalition, as opposed to City X versus City Y versus City Z, you know, figuring out, you know, what might be the best spot for an arena, you know, what kind of incentives might they be able to get, that kind of thing?
I mean, yes, in an ideal world. The problem is we've seen at the local level, you know, more partisanship. And I think, you know, you've seen some of the extremes take hold, which is part of why the Coyotes left in the first place. So I think that Tom is in the unique position to elevate this discussion above that. And so that probably makes the most sense right now.
All right, very quickly, just a couple of minutes left. I want to get your both of your takes on the sort of the position which Attorney General Chris Mayes finds herself now as it relates to the case of these so-called fake electors. Basically, a judge has said that they will not – the Court of Appeals did not reinstate the indictment against these folks. Daniel, obviously with the caveat, we're not lawyers in this room.
Mm-hmm.
If you were an advisor to Chris Mayes, what would you suggest you do?
If I was an advisor to Chris Mayes – which I'm not, but I would say, listen, in 2022, there was an 8-point Republican turnout advantage, and you basically won in a tie. The reason that you won, that Katie Hobbs won, is because a bunch of Republicans voted for you. And everything you've done since being elected has pushed those voters away. You're positioned yourself is the most progressive Democrat in the state, and you're not going to win re-election unless you drop this stuff. You've got to be focused on governing and doing your job, not on these more political lawsuits and just, you know, having Trump derangement syndrome.
Jason, I suspect the advice you would give Attorney General Mayes, were you an advisor, would be maybe slightly different than what Daniel would advise?
Just a little bit. Looking at the case, and by the way, I am an attorney, even though I don't practice. So I just play one occasionally. But looking at the case, I mean, obviously what was being said here is you got to go back and start from the beginning. It's not necessarily saying that she doesn't have a case. It's saying we want you to go back and get in front of the grand jury and give them a little bit more information you didn't do previously. So if I was advised, let's do that. Let's have that conversation. I think this is a conversation that the Attorney General continues to want to have. I think it's a strong conversation for Democrats to have. People tried to just step into the process and take over what's going on in our election. If we are true and committed to election integrity, this is something that we should be pursuing.
All right. We'll have to leave it there, guys. Jason Peraza, Daniel Scarpinato, thanks you both for the conversation. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Good morning and welcome back to the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, we'll hear how a state law expanding what's allowed for backyard guest houses is going.
But first, the story of Zorro, the mythic swashbuckler with a signature Z-shaped sword stroke, was originally created by American pulp fiction author Johnston McCulley in 1919. Zorro is a masked bandit who, armed with little more than a single blade, comes to the defense of the peasants in his hometown from overbearing state forces. Over the next century plus, Zorro has been reimagined and reinterpreted many times, perhaps most famously in the 1998 film The Mask of Zorro, starring Antonio Banderas. This weekend, a bold new musical interpretation of the story unfolds at the Arizona Opera. It's written and composed by Hector Armienta, a Chicano artist who wanted to add some personal and historical context to the legend of Zorro. I spoke with him last week.
I've incorporated a little bit of California history during the 1800s. There are some characters there that are actually drawn from history. And then the story's a little bit reshaped in terms of its overall message, which is, you know, usually the Zorro legend is, you know, this young Spanish man comes to save the day and everybody's, you know, Zorro, Zorro, which they do at the end of the opera, I promise. But it's also about the story of a young man in search of his destiny. And not him necessarily saving the day, which he does do, but it's also about empowering the people and realizing that the true power to change lies within them.
And what was important to you about introducing that element?
Part of it is my upbringing is about always searching for hope, always looking for light within the darkness. And I think that's the story of Zorro. It really just takes a spark. You know, and hope cannot be taken away from you.
If you're comfortable saying, I mean, you mentioned saying that that impulse has a bit to do with your upbringing. Can you expand on that a little bit? What do you relate to about that idea of looking for that spark to keep hope alive?
So it really was my mother who came from a very difficult background and life, and my grandmother. And I learned through them strength and power. And the one thing that really saved me was music. It is through that that I was able to escape my immediate neighborhood.
What you were just sharing made me think about something I heard you say in one interview, which was basically that you went, I think when you were pretty young in school, to see a classical music performance, and that there was something about it that just awakened you.
Yeah. So I grew up in California, and when I grew up, there was music in school. There were music programs. You know, every kid had the option of getting music. And we took, you know, we were buzzed to go to the Music Center, which is the main facility and main venue in Los Angeles. I'd never been introduced to classical music. And the power of the orchestra, of the music, and how it felt really was life-changing for me. So I bought all kinds of classical records. And eventually, when I studied opera, I felt that sort of the most powerful way of telling stories.
Mm. And do you remember, like, when you had that first experience with classical music, what was it about it that connected with you?
The sound. And when you ask me about my childhood, my father, you know, really wasn't around a lot. Mm. And the piano was there. The piano was my best friend at the time, you know. I would spend hours and hours just playing and practicing. I was like in a different world.
Yeah.
You know? Didn't know why. You know, I just...
but something about it felt right.
You're right. Yeah.
So this makes me think of what you said a moment ago about opera as such a wonderful way of telling stories. What is it about the nature of opera that fits in with stories as you understand them?
So theater, when it's a play, the information is primarily from the text, right? And of course, what the actors are doing. That's the messaging, right? In opera, opera is another character that you don't see on stage, but that you hear. So sometimes the music in the orchestra contradicts what you're seeing on stage. So when you think of, for example, Madame Butterfly, there are these beautiful melodies, or we call them motifs or leitmotifs. And it might be Madame Butterfly's theme, again, motif, and it's hopeful. But then as the opera progresses, that motif is twisted and changed. And then the words may say, you know, he's returning. But the music starts to change underneath. And the audience then is given this messaging that is contradictory to what you're seeing on stage. They're saying, Madame Butterfly, no, you're wrong. Listen to the orchestra.
So the audience in that moment knows more than the character.
That's right. That's right. So it's the unseen character. And that's one of the great powers of opera.
So coming back to this particular production, one of the other things you mentioned that I'm really interested in is setting the narrative in a particular time and place, California in the 1800s. What was interesting to you about that particular context?
Right. So there's a lot of important history that happened around that time. Prior to the 1800s, Spain was the world power. The empire, I think toward the end of the 18th century, started to fall apart. And the father, King Charles and Ferdinand, father and son, were battling for power. Then there was the rise of Napoleon. So it was because of that that they call it New Spain, parts of U.S., Central America, South America, the empire started to crumble. That's when the embers of revolution started to take hold in New Spain. So Zorro is about the plight of the poor and the destitute. And in the opera, what happens is that young Diego, teenager, is sent away to Spain by his father because Diego's having interest in a childhood friend who's not Spanish in Los Angeles. She's a mestiza, which is a person of mixed blood. So he goes to Spain to the military academy and decides to join the revolution in Spain. But his mentor, Sasueta, says, okay, look, this is not your destiny here. go back and find your destiny in Alta California. So he goes back, and it's that time when Mexico – well, not Mexico, but Spain at that time – revolution was starting to take hold, and that's what Zorro helps to be able to make change and also gives people hope.
I really see in when you lay it out that way the connection that you were alluding to earlier in our conversation about Diego, a.k.a. Zorro, finding his own destiny and rhyming that with the people of New Spain also coming into an awareness of their own ability to revolt, to step into their collective destiny.
Right. When Diego comes back, he reconnects with that childhood friend who he adored. It's through her that he learns and connects to that community.
Mm.
And in the very end of the opera, it's actually them, when all hope seems lost, that they empower him. But I won't give you more because then what's the point of seeing the opera?
Okay, well then let me ask you this. Do you ever watch your work being performed and wish that you were getting to perform it?
I'm smiling big because I probably would perform all my roles. You know? But I know better. When I write these shows, I call them shows, they're operas, but when I write these shows, there's a part of me that is in each of the characters and that the part of me that stays with them that I lose. So they become both my friends and my enemies.
Hmm.
And then, you know, eventually they leave me. It's a journey.
Well, I've been speaking with Héctor Armienta, who is the composer and librettist of Zorro, which will be performing on Saturday and Sunday, September 27th and 28th at Arizona Opera here in Phoenix, and then again on October 4th in Tucson. Héctor, thank you very much for this conversation.
Thanks a lot, Sam.
The promise of cooler weather is in the air, finally, and when it happens, many of us will be heading outdoors. That includes runners. But for some, it's not as simple as hitting the pavement. Phoenix artist Jen Erso creates maps that don't just mark landscapes, they provide social commentary. One is called A Guide to Running While Female in Central Phoenix. Erso talked about it last year with our co-host, Lauren Gilger.
I had been talking a lot with my partner about, you know, experience of running and realized in our conversation how much he didn't realize, like, what my experience was like versus his as a guy.
Hmm.
He was saying, you know, I love running at night in our neighborhood because it's nice and dark and quiet and nobody's there. And I'm like, that's precisely why I don't run in our neighborhood at night. I'm like, I stick to main streets. I do this. And I had also told him about an experience of going down this one street where this guy was always hassling me, you know, like, you know, yelling crude things at me. And so I just started to avoid that street. And he was like, well, that's not great because that's like altering your behavior. And I said, what do you think it's like every day? You know, like when I go run, I'm thinking about all of these things.
Wow.
You know, how I dress, what time I go. How populated is it? Is it a weekend? Is it a weekday? You know, I'm constantly thinking of all these different aspects before I step out the door.
Wow.
For my own safety. Mm-hmm. As somebody who's been running for now, God, I just turned 50, so I've been running for 37 years.
Wow. You know? Yeah. Always a factor and a lot of different factors. Okay. So this is radio, so you have to talk about what this looks like a little bit because people can't see it. It's a map of Central Phoenix, right? Like around where you live and where you run. And there are symbols on it like there are on many maps, but they're not kind of your average symbols. You've got bright lights, little sunshines, right? Like little kind of megaphone things. You've got one that's a little sports bra with a circle around it that's crossed out. So decode this for us. What are you describing?
So I was thinking of the different routes that I would take, and there were three things that stood out to me. It was like, where would I run only in the daylight?
Mm-hmm.
You know, where is it not safe to run at night? So a lot of that's like, I would never run on the canal at night. Mm. I don't care how lit they make it and how pretty they make it. Like, it's not an option. Mm-hmm. The little megaphone thing was places I remember being catcalled. Mm. And that's like remembered. It doesn't mean like those are all the places that I was – like, I was surely catcalled and honked at many other times.
The ones you can recall, yeah.
Like the ones that were especially egregious. Yeah. And then the other one is a sports bra with a line through it was – when I think about, like, I'm so hot, I just want to, like, run in my sports bra. But I know as soon as I take it off, there's, like, this transition where now I know I'm going to get honked at. Like, it's like I'm making myself open to it. Mm. And I've had moments where, like, I've been out running, no honking at all. And then the shirt comes off and I'm just in a sports bra. And then I get honked at or yelled at.
Immediately.
Yeah.
Wow. So talk about your own experiences in this. Like, it sounds like this is not, like, a great thing for you. Like, you've been running for a long time and running for a long time in Phoenix, but it's challenging. Like, I run a lot in the city as well. Does it ruin it for you? Like, I'm curious that you still do it, right?
I love running, and I love just the feeling of that my body can take me, you know, this long distance. And right now I'm training for a 50K, and it's like trying to imagine myself in a space like traveling that amount of, you know, those miles is incredible. There have been a lot of negative things that have happened to me in my life, and it's never, like, stopped me from doing the thing that I love to do. It's almost like, well, how can I overcome this, and how can I figure out a way to do it where I can still enjoy it? And, you know, would I like to go run on a trail by myself and feel safe? I would love that, but I'm not going to do it. Mm-hmm. But, oh, God, I don't know. Why do I still do it? Like, I couldn't not do it. And I would say, you know, 90% of the time, it's not like, you know, you're not getting harassed, but there's always a chance. Mm. And I think now that I'm an older woman, there's less of a chance. So I have that freedom of, like, being older and my sexual invisibility increasing, which has a little bit of a freedom to it. I kind of enjoy that.
Right. So you have this important kind of note at the bottom of this map. It's a P.S. And you say, like, this is ridiculous, right? Can you read that part for us?
It says, P.S. We know this is all ridiculous, right? I should be able to run anywhere in a sports bra and short shorts, young or old, skinny or fat, with headphones, without worrying about being raped or murdered, much less harassed and assaulted.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, the nature of this map was kind of meant to be sort of funny, like, you know, because I find it absurd and absurd things are hilarious. But it's also it's so frustrating, you know. And the thing that was really remarkable to me when this map came out. So, you know, all the women I've shown it to are like, yeah.
Yeah.
It's totally this is like just walking, you know, because it's not necessarily like running. It's anytime you're out alone. And then a friend of mine shared it, and then a male friend of hers shared it. Mm-hmm. And he got all of these comments and all of these reactions, all of these men saying, this is so sad. This is terrible. What does this say about our society? You know, and I'm just like, oh, my God, I'm shocked that they're shocked. Mm. Like, how did they not know? I think mostly it's because a lot of this stuff, we internalize it and we just do it because it's how we have to survive. Mm-hmm. And how we've learned to survive. I mean, like, I've had close calls. Like, I've had, as a teenager, some man following me in his car, hiding in a driveway. I had to run across a field from a high school to get him to shake him mm-hmm. from me. Mm-hmm. You know, I've had people, like, block me. I've had people pull over. I used to count the cars. Pay attention in my small town, like, oh, I've seen that car pass me now 4 times. Mm-hmm. Like, I need to change my route, or I need to turn around, or, you know, like, I've figured out all these little survival tactics. Yeah. I'm not paranoid, you know, like, it's happening.
No, we internalize this kind of stuff. So it seems so obvious. What do you think, like, is that part of the release of putting this out in the world, even if you didn't really kind of intend that when you did it?
Yeah, I mean, I think with a lot of the maps that I create, it's about giving a voice to something that I don't feel like has a voice, mm-hmm. you know. And it could be something silly or serious or a mixture of both, like this one is. You know, I wrote a blog post about this, and then that became my way of sort of expanding on this idea. And when I initially wrote it, I was thinking, this is just going to be me talking about it hitting a nerve with mm-hmm. people and how unusual that was. But then as I was writing it, it turned into this expose sort of my experience as a woman, as a girl, like being a runner and kind of the pain and the frustration of it, too. So I realized like how much more depth there was to this feeling of what, you know, the impetus behind creating this map in the first place.
Yeah.
It's like it makes me angry that this is the reality, but it's also the reality and it's not going to change tomorrow. So I don't know. What else can we do but give a voice to it and not sort of gaslight ourselves all the time? Mm-hmm. Like as soon as we make men aware and not like in an insistent like you need to see this, but just talk about it because this is reality.
Mm-hmm. All right. We'll leave it there. Jen Erso, artist, map maker here in Phoenix. Jen, thank you so much for coming in to talk about this. I really appreciate it.
Thanks.
Good morning and welcome back to the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Mark Brody. Arizona is about 9 months into a plan to allow more homeowners to build accessory dwelling units, or ADUs, otherwise known as casitas, on their property. Under a state law approved last year that went into effect on New Year's Day, cities with a population of more than 75,000 people are generally required to allow residents to build ADUs. Supporters argue it's a way to help ease the state's housing shortage, but critics point out the law does not preclude ADUs from being used as short-term rentals. To get a sense of what kind of impact the new law has had, we reached out to Xander Diamant, co-founder of Minimal Living Concepts, which builds ADUs. He joins me. And Xander, what have you seen since the start of the year with this new law in effect?
Honestly, we've had interest in what we've been doing since, you know, long before the ADU laws went into effect. And we get asked that question all the time, like how much has the ADU laws helped and with interest and buzz and all that stuff. And to be totally honest, prior to the ADU laws, we were already building ADUs. And it's not like it was super challenging to get ADUs built in both, Phoenix and Scottsdale. There were some nuances and some certain, you know, regulations we just had to kind of cater to. But for the most part, we've really always been able to do it. I think the biggest impact of the ADU legislation for us has just been really related to, you know, kind of what I alluded to, the buzz, the tailwind around ADUs, people kind of considering it as an option when maybe it was something that just wasn't even on their radar. And it went from something that was sort of a fringe thing to do where people would go, oh, you're building a guest house. Like what's that for? To something that is like really turning into the norm. And even a lot of the new builders that we come across, and we actually build full scale homes as well. And we're adding guest houses to our new builds. And a lot of other home builders are adding guest homes because it's just such a practical thing to do with your property. And we've all had, you know, grandma come stay with us or a friend, or, you know, you need that office, you need that gym space. So it just offers so much flexibility and it's just such a great way to enhance your existing property. So
what are you finding that the people for whom you're building them are building them for?
Well, that first use case that I mentioned has been honestly probably the most common, which is aging parents. Parents that are getting older, they want to sell their house. They're going to use the proceeds from their house to build a guest house and put the rest into their retirement account, and you know, want to be closer to the family, want to be closer to the grandkids. So really, like in-laws and snowbirds and aging parents has been the most common use case.
So it sounds like in at least some of these cases, it is sort of these ADUs are sort of having the effect that policymakers were hoping they would have in terms of providing housing, less expensive housing for people. But it also sounds like some builders, some homeowners are, as you say, sort of putting in gyms or offices or other space for their homes, which wouldn't really have that effect. So I'm curious, like, how would you say ADUs help deal with the housing crisis, the shortage of available and affordable housing for people?
Yeah, I think it's a great question. And so often, you know, we are looking for this in a very politically polarized kind of moment in history. We're all looking for this like be all end all solution to all of our problems or all of the country's problems. And the reality is like ADUs are not going to fix the housing crisis. They're not going to fix the affordability crisis. It's just one additional step that we can take that really doesn't have a downside, that does help ease the crisis. And another use case, by the way, speaking to your point, though, about why and how people are using these units, is people are also using them for their kids that are coming home from college. Hmm. And they're like, hey, instead of having my son go rent and be in whatever part of town where I don't see him and he's spending $3,000-$4,000 or has roommates or whatever, I'm going to put an ADU and my son's going to use it for the next couple of years so he can, you know, save up some dough. And when he's out, I'll use it for other things like a gym or an office. So I do think there is actually a lot of use case that relates back to affordability. But to your point, that's definitely not the only use case. I mean, of course, people are using them as gyms, pool houses, offices for working remote. I'm trying to think what else, art rooms, pottery rooms. There's really no use case like we haven't seen at this point. But, you know, just because one person is using it as a gym doesn't mean the next buyer of that home isn't going to use it for an aging parent or for a son or you know, or a live-in, you know.
Yeah.
So I think it's important to remember that, like, the guest house is there to stay. And what we've seen in a few of our clients who have sold the homes, one, the guest house was a primary feature of the sale. It was part of the reason the house went for the price it did, or part of the reason the buyer picked that house, because more and more people are looking for these additional non-attached spaces.
Are you finding that people are using them for short-term rentals?
Honestly, and this is the God honest truth, very few of my clients, and we've done over 120 of these projects, very few people that we have seen are using them for short-term rentals. Very few. Like, I could probably count on one hand how many of our clients that we know for a fact said, hey, I'm going to be using this for short-term rentals. Because I know that was the big fear for people, which, by the way, I don't even think that that's really something to be worried about, at least in the cases that I've seen. But that just hasn't been even close to one of the top five use cases that we've come across.
So understanding that, you know, depending on how people are going to use these guest houses will impact your answer to this. But I'm wondering if, in general, there are trends in terms of what people are asking for in their ADUs. Like, are there particular design elements or like room configurations that seem to be particularly popular?
Well, our best selling unit is the live model. That's like kind of our bread and butter, if you will. It's got, you know, one bed. It's got a full bathroom. It's got a full kitchen. When I say full kitchen, I mean, depending on the municipality, depending if we can put a range, depending if the client wants those things. And it's got like an actual living space. So I think what people want is really the flexibility. Hey, I need somebody to be able to stay in this and sleep in it and live in it and be comfortable. But if I wanted to use it as an office or use the living space as a gym and still maintain a bedroom, that flexibility, I think, has been the number one most important thing to people. It's not so often that we're getting like one specific request for something that is just becoming like a common need. I think the bathroom, you know, having the ability to add a washer and dryer, having enough closet space, like all of these things are considerations people are making when they're building a guest house, because if they're going to add something to their property and they're going to spend a lot of money, they want to know that, hey, no matter how I plan to use this, I'm going to be able to.
All right. That is Xander Diamant, co-founder of the company Minimal Living Concepts. Xander, thanks a lot. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Mark. Appreciate it.
Well, Mark, let's end today's show with some good news for people who love fly fishing and don't have much going on this weekend.
All right. The 19th annual Fly Fishing Film Tour, or F3T, will be at Moon Valley Country Club on Sunday.
Now, if you don't know, fly fishing uses a heavy rod and a light lure, as opposed to a light rod and a heavy lure. It also uses a specific type of lure called a fly. The flies are designed to mimic insects or other small aquatic creatures.
Yeah, and it turns out you can fly fish anywhere you'd be allowed to fish with a regular rod.
Now, Mark, I am personally surprised that there are enough fly fishing films for a whole tour.
Yeah, so this year's program includes 19 films. That's not a small number of films.
That's
19
a lot of
films.
Fly fishing films.
Yeah, there's one called Dan's Pain 2, which is about a man who has had so little luck with fly fishing, He thinks he's cursed.
Oh, dear. There are also two different films which follow athletes who turned to fly fishing after quitting their previous sports.
Now, if you're wondering why so many people are into fly fishing, the film Hooked unpacks the question amongst the madness of life, why are we obsessed with fly fishing?
You know, it sounds to me like the whole evening will be off the hook.
I'm sorry.
That was a grown-up delight,
yes,
right?
Indeed, yes, a grown-up delight. You can find out more about F3T at flyfilmtour.com. Kind of felt like we were fishing for a joke there, Sam.
Yes, we were trying to lure in the listeners.
Yeah. Okay, let's stop. We should stop right there. That'll do it for this Friday edition of the show. The show is produced by Sativa Peterson, Nick Sanchez, Amber Victoria Singer, Athena Ankra, and Ayanna Hamilton, as well as Bruce Drummond. Sky Shout is our digital editor. Claire Lawton is our newsletter editor. Chad Snow is the news director. The show is created by John Hoban. Our executive producer is Amy Silverman. For Sam Dingman and Lauren Gilger, I'm Mark Brody here in Phoenix. Have a terrific rest of your day. Have a great weekend. Hope to have you right back here on Monday. That's it for this episode of The Show podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.